Welcome to the Spike Feed, your leading Magic the Gathering podcast. What is up? My name is Curtis, and I'm just your typical Spike. On the line with me, after a brief hiatus, my good buddy, Cameron McCoy. What's up, man?
I'm doing well, man. And let's be honest, the real reason why we weren't on last week was solely because of you.
Right. Well, I mean, it was a decision that we made together. That's what I'm going to say.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So we very rarely miss a week. I want to say we've missed three times maybe in 160 episodes. So we pride ourselves on being regular. We'll say that. And we got on the air to record. And I mean, this really is all my wife's fault because I had some kind of throat thing.
You sounded awful. Yeah.
I sounded terrible. But like you do, you can't hear your own voice. You know, you rely on other people's opinions. I wake up in the morning, I say, hey, wife of mine, love of my life, do I sound okay to, you know, go on the air and record with Cameron? If not, I'll text him, and I need you to be honest with me. And she said, baby, I think you sound great, right? She's too supportive.
Yep.
Because when I got on the air, on the line with Cameron, he was laughing so hard he couldn't see straight. So we decided to postpone the show because I sounded like the raspy grandpa from Christmas Vacation.
It's true.
So, hey, but that means, you're going to get a better show this week. You're probably also going to get a little bit lengthier of a show because there's so much for us to talk about now.
Tons.
Tons, yeah. But, Cameron, hopefully you had a good holiday. Happy New Year's. We're recording this on New Year's Day.
Yeah, Happy New Year, man. Yeah, yeah.
I know these holidays mean a ton to you. But let's talk about what you've been doing lately. So when we last had the show, you had produced your second video, but now you've made your third one about making Stoneforge Mystic legal, which I think is super interesting. If you haven't checked out that video, go take a look. But what else have you been doing?
Let's see. So two things. One, I've been building my vintage deck for what I hope will be the first vintage Sherman of my life in like 2 weeks. So I'm super stoked for that. Currently, I think I'm going to be doing the blue-red Thing and Ice deck. I think you had played that a while ago on MTGO. It like tripped my trigger. It seemed really, really good. So that's the first deck that I'm going to be playing. We get 15 card proxy, which is, you know, not bad. It at least lets you get all the power cards out of the way, and then, you know, everything else is relatively cheap. If you have a legacy deck, you can very easily get into all the other non-power cards that you would need for a vintage deck. So playing that, I will have a report here in, you know, 2 weeks, but I'm so looking forward to that. I think it's going to be just utter nonsense to play vintage like that.
Okay, random question for you. How many Ingot Chewers do you have?
What is that? I don't know.
It's an evoke creature that when you evoke it for one red mana, it destroys an artifact.
Oh, okay.
And so you desperately, desperately need that card against shops.
Yeah.
Because you're evoking a creature, the tax effect doesn't impact it for like Thorn of Amethyst.
Nice.
And so it's your number one way around artifacts. So when I played that deck, I leaned heavily on that. Now, because the mana is so good, because it's a blue-red, and I'm assuming you're playing Gush in this deck as well.
Yep, yep.
That, you know, you really have to, you can actually get out ahead of a shops deck versus like the four-color mentor decks sometimes can have weird mana or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you'll have a great time, man. I'm super jealous. Part of me just wants to just go show up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And play some vintage with you.
Mm-hmm.
God, I love Vintage Storm. It's not good right now, but I love Vintage Storm.
It doesn't matter. It's all just absurd. It's so much fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In addition to that, I actually been playing some like legitimate Legacy, and something appeared on MTG Goldfish a while ago that was a blue-white flash deck, as I think a lot of people are. I was really excited about Spellqueller. Is it good enough in Legacy? Probably not, but that doesn't mean I should be stifled from actually playing it in a deck if I want to experiment, right? So anyway, this blue-white flash deck uses Judge's Familiar and Mausoleum Wanderer on turn one for like your counter instant sorcery or instant or sorcery spell unless your opponent plays one. So, and you play Wastelands, you have a Crucible in there, and it's all about just tempo, right? You're just, it has your Stoneforge package as well, and then Spell Queller's in there, and I'm running two Thalias just because I love Thalia so much, and she seems to kind of fit that tempo package in some ways.
Especially in Legacy.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm in love with this. I've only been playing this through the tournament practice room, but I've been having really good success, and I might run it through a league here, and then next week for Legacy Friday night, I'll probably play it because I have all the cards as well, so I'll probably be able to play it in paper as well. But, you know, I mean, it's fun to play. I mean, if Stoneforge is like my base package, I feel like there's a lot of just different things that you can do to kind of experiment around those cards, those specific cards, to have maybe some fun and keep your opponents on their toes. So we'll see what happens. I mean, overall, it seems to be working better than, like, you know, your Esper Stoneblade pack or list, just because I feel like I always have something to do on turn one, which can be so crucial in so many matches. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah, I actually agree with you pretty heavily. I think one of the big problems with Stoneblade, which has seen a slight resurgence in Legacy, if you look at the metagame breakdowns, the big problem is being active on turn one and turn two. One of the main reasons I was such a proponent for Jace's Rim's Prodigy in that deck is having another turn two play that kind of puts some sort of pressure on your opponent. Because if not, then you're kind of in this weird spot where if you're not the control deck, right?
Yeah.
Like if it's lands or miracles or whatever, you're in a real difficult spot because that deck just has difficulty producing that pressure, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so is there anything else you played before we move on, Cam?
No, that's it. I might play some Modern here and play some more fairies with the blue-black package with the Smuggler's Copter, but I don't have anything to report on that yet.
Okay. Well, just real quickly, I wanted to talk about, I've been playing a lot of different things. So Legacy, I've just been playing Storm still. Just in the tournament practice room, just kind of finding my feet, finding the build that I like. You know, it's been so hit and miss, and I'm definitely the kind of guy that I need a lot of reps before I feel comfortable with the deck or in a limited format. We've talked about this before. And whenever I'm only touching Magic Online once every, like, 4 days, it's a little bit tough to, especially something like Storm, which, you know, I feel like I'm not terrible with. But some of the little more ins and outs, like, do I want two copies of Tendrils across my 75? Stuff like that. It's just really, it's really difficult for me. So what I did as a default, though, with my time off is I played some Vintage Cube. And Vintage Cube is an amazing, amazing product. I feel like we have this talk with almost everything about Magic Online. It's an amazing product. It is weird in a league structure for Cube. Like, I feel the weirdness more than I do with a regular limited set because I drafted a Storm deck, and my first two matches, I lost to other Storm decks. And you just have this weird, like, no, time out. Wait, I'm the Storm deck in this pod.
Yeah.
But that's not what happens because it's a league structure. So I don't know how much of it is my discomfort versus, you know, what I'm used to, or they just need to design it to where it's not as strange, or maybe I was just forcing Storm too often, which is highly probable. But it is still a great time. But I just, like, I think I cubed like 3 or 4 times on, you know, one buy-in, but I still felt like that $10 just, like, I just totally just threw it into the wind.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so that's something that it's kind of rough from a value perspective to cube, but it is just so outrageously fun. I do want to point out that I did Mind's Desire somebody for 11, which was hysterical. Do you know what Mind's Desire does, Cameron?
Help me out. I know of the card, but I don't think I know it.
So basically, it's a 6-mana Storm card, and you shuffle your library, remove the top card of the deck, and then you get to cast it for free.
Okay.
And so it's got Storm, so you can do that for like 11, and you have to do that 11 times. I mean, this card could not be more banned in Legacy if it wanted to be, right? It would just be so absurd. But I cast an Imrakul and an Ugin, like new Imrakul, off this. So Vintage Cube just really enables those kinds of fun things to happen. Last thing I want to mention is I am slowly and very gingerly kind of moving back into Modern. just because my local scene, and you know, it looks like we're going to GP Omaha, which is standard. But if I'm going to side table, it's likely that I'm going to side table in modern or draft, and so I just want to have some reps in modern. But you know, as you've said a million times, maybe the format is not where we would like it to be. Well, I need to just get hands on it more often than I am right now, right? But this whole debate of frontier versus modern is really pushing through the community, and I feel like we have a very steadfast, like, modern should be better than what it is, but it's fine. And if frontier exists, it'll be okay. Maybe it could be better, right? So wonderfully nuanced opinion on our part, right?
I guess, yeah.
All right, Cameron. Yeah, I guess too, right? All right, hey, we've missed a handful of spoilers, so we're going to come back. We're going to talk about those. And then we're going to kind of do a what we would have done last week, which is a 2016 year in review. We're going to go through that. We'll be right back. All right, guys, welcome back. Let's talk very quickly about some spoilers. Some new cards were spoiled through the Mothership and the Masterpieces. So just real quickly, Cameron, we definitely don't need to go through the Masterpieces in terms of card by card of the old stuff. I don't know that I have terribly, you know, a lot new to say about it, but what are your thoughts as a whole on this set of Masterpieces?
Just once again, as coming from like a modern and legacy player, it's nice to see certain cards that are getting reprints technically that will hopefully drive the prices down a little bit for some of those, you know, sideboard staples, Ensnaring Bridge, Engineered Explosives, the Swords. These are cards that, Chalice, you know, these are cards that are getting upwards of $50+. And so it's great to see these kind of, you know, create a premium in one way and then just, you know, hopefully put more of those cards into the wild. So, I mean, I'm a broken record with these. I love the Masterpiece sets. I think they are exactly what should be happening across the board for Wizards. And I'm hopeful that they'll continue doing this throughout the future.
Yeah, I'm kind of there with you. I mean, the cards that they chose, I mean, there was some level of like people upset that there's Ornithopter and why is there Ornithopter? And I think it's fine. Whatever. Like, I just think it's fine.
Yeah.
Whatever. I know that's not like controversial. Maybe I should like find a way to get upset or whatever. there's an Ensnaring Bridge, but it doesn't look like a bridge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
These are things that I'm not really too worried about. Anyway, so I have this first spoiler for you, Cameron. We did two of the Masterpieces are obviously from the set, and I think they're worth talking about. So I'm going to set you up with Planar Bridge.
All right, Planar Bridge costs 6. It's a legendary artifact. Pay 8 and tap. Search your library for a permanent card. Put it onto the battlefield, then shuffle your library. So what? I mean, this is going in 12 posts, right? Where else is it really going to exist? Seems kind of right up there with like the Eldrazi tutor effect or whatever. Or is it the Eldrazi tutor effect or whatever it is? So very similar in that sense. Seems like a decent card.
You know, I want you to think bigger, Cameron. Don't just think 12 post.
Okay.
Right? Think about something like, I don't know, getting an Omniscience or an Enter the Infinite. Or anything that is just crazy. I mean, the baseline, I think, is you could potentially put this in Modern Tron as a one of to toolbox to a bazillion different sideboard cards or things that you might need. I don't know if that's better or worse than just having a million things. I don't play Tron, so I don't know how often you hit an Ugin when you need a Karn or vice versa. I mean, that's all in theory possible, right? But you're right. Legacy is where this ends up being insane, where, you know, you could just use it with the Metalworker deck.
Yeah.
Which we haven't seen a Metalworker deck in forever. But I think we can all agree that the ability on this card is absurd. It's just a matter of, you know, abusing the mana. In Standard, will this do anything? I would say almost definitely not, right?
Yeah.
But it is pretty sweet. Okay, so other card. This one's weird. So Paradox Engine is a 5-mana legendary artifact. Whenever you cast a spell, untap all non-land permanents you control.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about combo elves in Modern. Right? So, I don't know if this is faster or better than anything they have on offer, but if you're able to get this going, you could do some silly, silly, silly things, right? With Nettle Sentinels, etc. There is also some serious combo potential within the context of mana creatures, Jeskai Ascendancy, that kind of thing. I mean, Cameron, where do you come out on this card?
Everything that you're talking about is really, really good. And I think for this to be like combo elf potential or even like Jeskai Ascendancy potential, I think it needs to be less than 5 for a casting cost. Like, that's a huge investment, you know, to begin with. However, I mean, the potential of the effect that you can get from that is absurd. So, yeah, I think this has potential. Whether or not that casting cost of 5, if you know, what are you doing for those subsequent or those prior 4 turns, you know, really matters. And so we'll see. Like, interesting combo potential. If it can actually get there, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I just, you know, because Jeskai Ascendancy, whenever you're playing that in Modern, and you've been playing that a little bit lately, even just turn 3 doing nothing feels like a huge expenditure on your part,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so, you know, this at level at 5. Now, when I first read this, I thought it said all permanents you control, and I was like, whoa, whoa. But it is just non-land permanent. So there could also just be some kind of weird artifact, eggs, combo kind of deck where you're utilizing things like Ghirapur Aether Grid or something like that to draw cards or to tap artifacts, etc. So some cool stuff there. Now, Cameron, I'm going to give you Tezzeret. We're going to talk about it. This has been one of the more debated cards in the set.
Okay. So, I have, like, really nothing to... I just saw this card, like, today. I haven't been keeping up on it. So, here's my opinion. Tezzeret, the Schemer, costs 2 colorless, a blue and a black. He's a planeswalker with a starting out loyalty of 5. +1, create a colorless artifact token named Ethereum Cell with tap, sacrifices artifact. Add 1 mana of any color to your mana pool. -2, target creature gets +X/-X. Until unturned, where X is the number of artifacts you control. And -7, you get an emblem with, at the beginning of combat on your turn, target artifact you control becomes an artifact creature with base power and toughness of 5/5. Interesting Tezzeret card, right? I really like that the utility of a -2, that seems really saucy, where you can use that for your own artifacts, obviously, or for, you know, the possibility of clearing maybe a threat on your opponent's end. So that is interesting. The just generating an additional mana is, you know, okay. I mean, you can build those up over time, and that's great, but I don't know. I don't know. Like, this, it seems like a fine card. I think it'll be great in Standard, especially with all the artifacts floating around. Beyond that, I don't know. This seems just kind of like a vanilla Tezzeret card.
Yeah, I would say it's indicative of a lot of the planeswalkers we've been seeing lately, right? Outside of Liliana or Chandra, and I'd say Nissa as well, but a lot of the cards, the planeswalkers we've been seeing, they just feel kind of very vanilla and very... uninteresting in that their abilities, you know, the plus generates something, the negative kills something or bounces something. Like, this just feels like Obnixilis or Jace.
Exactly.
Or, yeah. You know, any of those. Like, nothing that really excites me. Now, the problem is with this in Standard is, the problem with everything in Standard is going to be the amount of top-down pressure Imrakul is putting on the format. Right, everything has to be judged through the lens of, okay, well, if an Imrakul gets cast on turn 7, what are you doing? Right? And Imrakul, by the way, in the context of the Aetherworks Marvel is happening even sooner than that, right? It can happen turn five.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to feel really silly making a Lotus Petal when they're making an Emrakul, right?
Yeah.
That being said, there is a lot to like about this card. It does, I mean, I know a lot of people, oh, Lotus Petal. Like, jumping from, you know, five to six mana after he comes into play is not nothing.
Yep.
Right? It's actually even more than that, right? Because you can plus him twice if your opponent doesn't kill him.
Yes.
So it's a really large jump in terms of mana. It's not nothing. Secondly, that minus, there are weird scenarios you can come up with where, let's say, you're a Metalwork Colossus deck, and the plus X minus X, you know, you use to give your Metalwork Colossus, he becomes a, you know, 16-4, and you just kill your opponent in one shot.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some cool things that he can do. The problem is a very dirtily artifact deck just doesn't seem like it will work right now.
Yes.
And even because I know a lot of people said, oh, once Aetherworks Marvel, you know, once Emrakul's gone, Aetherworks Marvel will be fine. Are we really sure about that? I mean, all the rest of that engine can produce cards that are pretty expensive and pretty nice. Even if it's Demon of Dark Schemes, that's a huge problem for you if you're playing Tezzeret. So I'm a little bit leery of the context. Aetherworks Marvel is, I think, a card we're going to get pretty sick of pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this guy is in that deck, but I just don't. I don't think so. I don't think so. Anyway, so that's just kind of where I'm at. So let's talk year in review, Cameron. So 2016, today left us. I can tell you're pretty upset.
Oh, totally. It was a year. We'll say that.
It was a year. A year in the life, right?
Yep.
So I just want it, because I don't want to go through like a million different categories and most important card and all that kind of stuff. I want to boil it down to sets.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because that's how we tend to look at, you know, the new cycle for Magic is preview season, what season is standard, kind of what's happened. And in 2016, I mean, we're talking about a major year in the life cycle of Magic, okay? Yep. So I'm going to list off the sets for you, and I just want you to list your, you know, top three or, you know, top two, whatever comes to your brain. So we start out with Oath of the Gatewatch.
Ah, yes.
Shadows over Innistrad, Eldritch Moon, Kaladesh, and in between there were Eternal Masters, Commander 2016, and Conspiracy : Take the Crown, which we usually called Conspiracy 2 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was our code name for
or whatever.
Conspiracy or whatever. So, and then we would say, is there a second one or is that the third one? You know, we would have that whole, it's like Ice Age movies to us.
Yeah, yeah.
We're vaguely aware that there's a quantity of them, but we don't know how many.
Which is hilarious anyway, because like, as you're like going over all of this, like, I want to say that Conspiracy for me might be the most impactful set for me personally, right?
Okay.
I just seeing the volume of reprints that came out of Conspiracy at just a standard MSRP price for a pack of cards meant that we got things like Show and Tell, you know, back out into the wild, Inquisition of Kozilek, Serum Visions. I mean, there was a ton of really good value cards that came out of Conspiracy. And honestly, I mean, I played Conspiracy once, drafted it, and had a total blast. I mean, drafting it, the multiplayer Magic part I didn't really enjoy, but the actual drafting of it, man, it was a blast. I thought like the set itself with all the mechanics and everything, they totally nailed it with it. So, Conspiracy was numero uno as far as like, for me, the most important set to come out of Magic. And then also Shadows. I drafted Shadows so much. Like, I felt like once a week I was just on MTGO, I'll draft Shadows, why not? Did it have like the most value out of cards? No. You know, a lot of those decks that I thought were going to be impactful really weren't. But there was just so much I liked about going back to Innistrad and the mechanics, the vampires, all that stuff I just really, really dug. So you know, I thought Shadows, while not hugely impactful, like on the larger standard game, I would say, I still really dug it as a set.
So, I mean, Shadows had standard impact. I mean,
yeah, it did. I guess,
Lands, Tireless Tracker, Avacyn, give it some credit, man. Yeah. It's not a dud. So for me, set of the year, no problem, was Eldritch Moon. Eldritch Moon is one of my Desert Island favorite sets of all time. I totally thought I would hate it going in, and I thought it was fantastic as a limited set. It's obviously a big deal as a constructed set, mm-hmm. But I just found that there was a lot of interesting interactive matches that would happen in the limited context. So that would be my number one. And number two, I guess, would be Shadows. I don't know. We're going to get to disappointments here in a minute.
Uh-huh.
But maybe I just, you know, the Innistrad thing. I mean, Kaladesh was fine. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. I wasn't necessarily a big fan of the limited format I just thought it was, they were kind of in, you just feel like you're tinkering all the time with like these weird random energy cards and stuff. While it was engaging at a certain level, on the other hand, I didn't have as much fun with it as I would have liked. So let me throw it to you in terms of disappointments, because I think there's a lot to say here. In terms of sets, we'll start there.
Biggest disappointment for me was, it has to be Internal Masters. The Masters thing, I don't like, because I feel like there's like this inflated sense of like there it's a limited print run, you know, there's only so much, it's a premium product, and I never feel like it's a premium product. I never felt like I was getting the value out of that, just cracking open those packs or drafting it. It just was overall just this weird thing where it's like we're upcharging you on this set that's going to be limited and it's premium, and you can invest $90 and come away with, you know, 13. So, like, overall, that's the biggest disappointment for me.
I totally want to echo what you have to say.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Eternal Masters was a great opportunity for them to make a change to Eternal Magic as well. Like, mm-hmm. looking back on it, I feel very strongly about this. That is the point in which they should have said, there will be no Reserveless Legacy. I mean, or, you know, hey, in my dreamland, in Magical Christmas land, they would have gotten rid of the reserve list and announced that. That would have been fantastic. I think it was well-intentioned. A few huge missteps. Number one, announcing it and right off the bat saying, hey, the reserve list cards are fine. You know, we're not going to reprint any of those. Made dual lands, especially on Magic Online, Lion's Eye Diamond, all those things go super up as speculators just jumped in. And it made the Eternal Masters set itself unengaging for people that just want to draft it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the value was so skewed into the Mythics that it just felt like a really bad, like you said, an upsell, bait and switch or whatever, mm-hmm. where we could have had this at a much more affordable place. The whole Masters setup just feels so anti-player at this stage, where, I mean, hey, look, I know you guys put $10 suggested retail price on the box, but what actually happens is I pay $45 for a draft.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And I draft it one time, and here's what happened. Draft it, open a wasteland. I'm in a shop full of people, and because I'm in a city where Eternal Magic does not matter, I walked around going, hey, does anybody want a wasteland? I'm going to trade it real cheap. And I walked around trying to hawk this wasteland that nobody wanted, because while the prices online are high, the prices locally for me, nobody wants it. Nobody wants it for anything. And it just created a real awkward, like, I just spent $45, I opened one of the Chase Rares, and I can do nothing with it. And the shop that I was in wasn't going to offer me, they were going to offer me like $10 for it or something, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And so I just, not only am I unhappy where it was at economically, I don't think it played great. I felt like it was a lottery thing. I think it was a huge mistake to include vintage cards. Like, why, you know? So there's a lot of problems. I do also want to just mention Oath of the Gatewatch as a disappointment as well. I think the introduction of the quote-unquote six color or colorless mana or whatever you want to call it was intriguing to begin with and has now ended up being a major annoyance for Magic Online players that they have done nothing with since. It is completely ridiculous that they haven't added colorless in terms of casting costs since, especially with Emrakul. We wouldn't even be having these discussions about new Emrakul if colorless was in his casting cost, right?
Yeah.
I don't know why they dropped it, but it was just like, everybody knows this guy, right? This guy that as soon as he starts dating a girl, like a weekend, he's like, it's for real this time. I can see myself marrying her. We're going to move to Texas.
Uh-huh.
I met her online and magic happened. You know, all this, they just bloviate about how serious it is. And then 2 weeks later, you don't hear another thing and he's on to the next girl, right?
Yep.
This is what this feels like. They're like, guys, colorless mana. It's a thing. We're changing all of old magic. It's going to change magic in the future. You won't even believe it. And instead, what it's effectively done is it ruined modern for a few months and has completely messed up legacy. And they've acted like it never happened, right?
Yeah.
So, anyway, Oath of the Gatewatch, not my favorite set to draft either, but limited stuff aside, Commander 2016, I don't feel like we have any reasonable thing to say about that. I'm sure it's great. But Kaladesh is kind of in the middle for me, but I would actually put Shadows as my number two as well. I really liked it.
Yeah.
Any other trends from this year that you wanted to talk about, Cameron? Like, as a whole, as we've been covering Magic week to week.
You know, I'm trying to remember, did Splinter Twin get banned this year? Was that this 2016?
I don't think so. Okay. But, man, I don't know.
I can't remember. But
charting the modern ban list, like, without looking at it on, like, on a website or whatever is next to impossible.
It is, yeah. It fluctuates.
It's changed a lot.
But, you know, I mean, as much as we complain about modern, I'm holding out hope for that format as far as, you know, becoming a little bit more interactive. I've obviously, you know, stated my claim on certain cards I want to see unbanned, but I don't know. I think it's just crazy to see that, and it's great to see the diversity that does exist. Maybe it's not the diversity that I want to see, but ever since Splinter Twin has gone away and Pod, I don't know, there does seem to be, at least in my shop's meta, some good diversity happening. So, yay to that.
Yeah, and I do think, because we tend to get some feedback on Modern about how negative we are and how disappointed people are in our opinions on it. I want to say this, like, we're always coming from a place of wanting the game to improve,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, we would love nothing more for Modern to be our favorite format. It would make our lives so much easier.
It'd be very easy. Right.
But, you know, hey, I'm hopeful too. And I really think they're going to make some changes to the ban list. And I will be so excited for when that happens. I do also want to mention this year seen the real reduction of weekly streaming of Magic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Star City Games and WotC itself, while it had been kind of started to decline in 2015, this is the first year where it was like, hey, 3 weeks go by and there's nothing on, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's been, I think, horrific for the game. Just bad as a whole. Now, I know it takes a ton of energy and work to stream a live event, and I'm not expecting that every weekend, right? And I understand that they did that because there was money to be lost.
For sure.
Right? If it was profitable, they would keep doing it. But I also think that, you know, especially WotC needs to have something on the weekends pretty regularly, whether it's restreaming the Pro Tour or whatever, to try and get this, you know, to try and be more engaging to people that want to know what Magic is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I'd like to see changed. I mean, we'll go like over our 2017 wish list next week. But you know, the other trend I would say is this kind of apathy towards Standard. And I think, while I don't necessarily share this opinion, we can definitely say that we've had three Standards in a row where the complaints have sounded a lot louder than they have in the past.
Sure.
Right? Especially in the 4 years of doing this show, I'd say this last calendar year, Standard has been a bigger whipping boy than ever. And I don't know if it's going to change. I mean, some people have even floated the idea of about bands. I don't think we're anywhere near that. but I mean, apparently tournament attendance is down for Standard. Now, Cameron, is that something you've seen at your shop?
Yeah, actually I have. I mean, just it's crazy to think that like with when Oath of Gatewatch came out, I mean, like you're seeing some really high Standard attendance, despite the fact that, you know, Jace was still like a $70 card at the time, right? Or I can't remember how high it got. It was high, right? And those top performing Standard decks were extremely high. It's weird because, like, for the most part, Standard seems to be relatively accessible. But, you know, there's like 10 to 12 people showing up to our Standard event versus 30 to 40 for Modern, right? So I don't know what that means. Hopefully just with another set release that will change, but who knows? I don't know. It's weird, though, to see such low attendance.
Yeah, and it's something that Wizard obviously has to write because, like it or not, Standard is the lifeblood of the game, right? If they're not able to sell new sets,
yeah,
then you don't get a game, right? And I think there's a little bit of wishful thinking when it comes to Modern and Frontier, and people say, oh, I'm just going to play this, and this is going to be the thing I do, and I'm just going to move on from Standard. I understand the desire, and I'm not saying Standard is for everybody, but I think at the competitive level, the number one thing has to be Standard for the marketing and consumption of this game. It just does, you know? Mm-hmm. And I really hope, whether it's in the form of bands or being more creative about how they market the tournament structure, they really need to do something if we see a reduction, because the game is not bad. The game is still well designed. Okay, Cameron. So we've gone on and on. Next week, we will go over our official 2017 wish list, which I'm excited about. We're going to talk about stuff that's been going on with us, and we'll be right back after this. All right, Cameron. So let's talk very, very quickly about our weeks, what's been going on our past couple weeks. There's a lot to say. I know you've probably just been sitting around playing Overwatch for 2 weeks solid.
Yeah, nothing but Overwatch. And also saw the movie La La Land, which stars Ryan Reynolds and Ryan Gosling, excuse me, and Emma Stone. Wow,
got one my thing Ryan's we do confused. Not do on this show is mess up our Ryans,
right?
Okay.
So
starring Ryan Seacrest.
Yeah, Ryan Seacrest. And it's a musical. A musical in 2016, 2017. And it's good. So I don't know if we've ever talked about it, but did you see the director's last movie, which is escaping me right now, and I can't remember what it's called. But it's all about jazz and like this kid who performs, and it's really, really good. Wow.
Whiplash,
thank you. One of my favorite movies, actually. From that year.
I haven't seen Whiplash. I know it exists, but okay, that's it.
Go see Whiplash first. This is the director.
I hear the guy is like a really strict mentor and is really harsh to his pupils.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So can you relate a lot to that?
Me and you. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. I like that movie.
La La Land is a musical. If you've seen the trailer, you've probably seen some like really stunning cinematography, lighting, camera composition, and all of that. And that's the reason to go see this movie, I think. Man, is it gorgeous. It's just like this callback to like 1950s musicals and like that jazz era of like the early 60s. There's just so much there that's just visual eye candy that somebody who's like me personally, not a huge musical fan, I can get totally behind because there's just so much to take in. To the point where I'd almost recommend to go see this in the theater because of the visuals. It's stunning. It's gorgeous. I could just watch the lighting and how they did that and just a masterclass in that, for the rest of my life. It's great. So, La La Land. Yeah. The movie itself, it struggles in some points. I would say it forgets to be a musical halfway through and then picks back up. But overall, I would give it a solid recommend.
Yeah, that's in wide release now, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah,
I've heard it's great Oscar worthy, and then I've heard hugely disappointing. So I've heard both ends.
Okay. Yeah. So I would say it falls right in the middle.
You know, and I have to ask, Cameron, so just given current events and all that kind of thing, have you seen Singing in the Rain?
Not recently, no. I mean, I have, okay. But it's been like years, so.
Yeah, I've kind of been stuck with that. So, you know, obviously Debbie Reynolds died.
Mm-hmm.
And so multiple people I've mentioned, have you seen Singing in the Rain, which is an older film, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was my grandmother's favorite film. And so I'd seen it a number of times as a kid. And I keep mentioning to people, and I mean, even my in-laws, you know, were like, no, I've never seen that. And I'm like, wow, it's such an important movie to see, you know, hey, check it out sometime.
It's iconic, for sure.
Iconic, such high energy. I mean, it's also weird to see people dancing. Like, we don't understand, you know, dancing even 50, 60 years ago, what that looked like compared to what we're used to. You know, it's mm-hmm. changed so much.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great film. Anyway, and just, you know, I think too many people in our generation think of Debbie Reynolds as Carrie Fisher's mom. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's so tied in with that story. But, I mean, an incredibly important actress in her own right.
For sure.
Anyway, so I want to talk about a couple things here. First of all, Gears of War 4. So I got gifted some gift cards.
Mm-hmm.
And let me, my relationship with the Gears of War series is complicated, okay?
Okay.
I just want to say this. I think the stories are, what's the most charitable way to describe them?
Oh,
awful.
Yeah, yeah.
A waste of a cutscene. Not worth the effort that was put into them. Not a fan of the stories, right? And I actually, in terms of Xbox franchise, I always think that Halo is, you know, definitely the first chair, right? Mm-hmm. And Gears of War is kind of like, meh. But I have to, you know, hey, they sail by on these, on a really great mechanic, and you play that mechanic for 8 or 9 hours in the campaign, and then you move on with your life, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I got to be honest with you, man. Gears of War 4's story is not awful. Is it good? No. But it is not awful.
It's the most we can hope for.
And I really like the campaign. Like, it is just a total cheeseburger. I'm just going to put it to you like this, right? Like, because somebody asked me, like, well, if you don't like Dishonored 2, but you're liking Gears of War 4, how does that connect? You know, it's like this. Dishonored 2 is like this really great French meal. You go to, you get reservations, and then, oh, the duck is overcooked, right? Mm-hmm. And it just kind of messes up. Gears of War 4 is, hey, I just went to the grease stop to get a double bacon cheeseburger. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It knows what it is, top to bottom.
Consistent. Yep.
Consistent. Hey, how do you feel about a gunfight? Would you like to play an entire game where you are in said gunfight? So what you get.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, hey, I would not put it as a $60 game if you're not going to play the multiplayer, which I didn't. But I've really enjoyed it. The campaign is a ton of fun, lots of set pieces, a lot like an Uncharted campaign, you know?
Yeah.
Just with a worse story, but better gunfights.
Cool.
There you go.
All right.
Better recommendation, okay? So, because, you know, you and I are such proponents for Marvel Unlimited, that's such a high-value service that I feel like I've neglected my DCU roots, okay?
Sure.
Just to put this in perspective, I have a Superman and Batman figure hanging from my rearview mirror in my car. Like, these are characters that I love.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had a rough go the past few years.
Oh, yeah.
Largely because of their films. But I'd been recommended this story that I totally missed called Batman Court of Owls. And it's written by Scott Snyder and drawn by Greg Capullo, who drew Spawn for like a decade.
Oh, wow.
Okay, after Todd McFarlane. And I'd heard such positive things, and I never picked it up. Well, I got the trade from my brother-in-law for Christmas. And awesome. Awesome, classic Batman. I mean, just what you want a Batman story to be. Fantastically drawn. There's a great mystery. There's Batman pushing himself too hard. And, you know, Dick Grayson telling him, hey, you need to chill out. And there's all this intrigue about the history of Gotham and Bruce Wayne's family.
Hmm.
I'm only one of the three trades in, but man, it was just what I needed. And it's just such a reminder of what's great about that character. You know,
that's awesome.
Anyway, I alluded to it earlier, but we should mention, because we talk so much about Star Wars, The passing of Carrie Fisher.
It hurt, man. It hurt. Yeah.
It hurt a ton, man. And so I just wanted your thoughts on it. You know, how did it hit you? And, you know, talk to me about your thoughts on Carrie Fisher as a whole, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Carrie Fisher, I mean, it's funny because, like, growing up in the 90s, I honestly did not, I'd seen Star Wars, but there wasn't like this really huge connection with me. I was much more of like this Star Trek guy. And I remember, I think I had a closer connection to Carrie Fisher from when Harry Met Sally, which is, you know, kind of hilarious, right?
It's a great movie.
Yeah, it's an incredible movie. So, you know, just beyond Star Wars, I think she has done a lot. She was a great comedian. She was a good writer. She was just overall, you know, a very talented actress. And so it was really hard. I was just bummed. And it just was like added to this list of like really incredible people who died in 2016. And, you know, all years there's always like this in memoriam with like a huge number of people who have died. But this year, for some reason, just with like Bowie and Prince and now Carrie Fisher, like there's this, I think, a stronger connection to a lot of that body of work from these people, to where it just hurts more. So, yeah, it totally sucks.
Yeah, agreed. And I just, you know, for me, hey, Star Wars and Return of the Jedi were two of the six movies I owned as a kid until I was probably 10 years old, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, we just did not have a ton of movies, VHSs, whatever. And, I mean, I almost wish I could go back, you know, because the discussion about her as Princess Leia has been so frustrating this last week. Because, and I largely blame Friends for this stereotype, that if you are into geek culture and you like Princess Leia, it's because of this metal bikini, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I wish we could just travel back in time and excise those sequences from Return of the Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
Because she created so much of that character. I mean, there's scripts floating around where she rewrote her dialogue from what George Lucas had given her, right? So if you ever want to know why her dialogue is so much more well-presented than, I don't know, say, the stuff that we saw in episode two, well, it's because she redoctored a ton of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the character is such a strong, confident female character. And guys, there are not a ton of those in those early 80s pictures. Like, go back and watch some of this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Go back and watch Conan. This is not the same. It's almost like it's not in the same universe, you know? And I just really feel like that character and her as an actress have been done a little bit of a disservice, and that's been a bummer for me. But, I mean, fantastic. And also, scriptwriter, I always think of her as her cameos in not just Austin Powers, but she was also recently in that Amazon show we love called Catastrophe,
where she played
the crazy mother-in-law.
Yeah.
You know, so it's such a bummer. I mean, honestly, the performance I liked the least by her was in Force Awakens. And so, yeah, it's just such a drag. And, you know, hey, not to be this Captain 2016 celebrity thing, because I think
we could
fill up a whole hour with those people and what they've meant to us. But that one especially hit. So, Cameron, someone would like to talk to you about Star Wars, La La Land, Magic in 2016, Legacy, or your fantastic YouTube video series. Where could they go?
It's all on Twitter, @Cameron_McCoy.
And I'm @CurtisNow. Our official show feed is @SpikeFeedMTG. We will check you guys next week.